available that would be effective and could be used on a large scale. The most effective reply would be a counter-threat with a similar weapon. Thus, in the first months of 1940, it was already clear to two intelligent observers that nuclear weapons would be weapons of mass destruction, against which the only apparent defense would be the deterrent effect of mutual possession. Frisch and Pirls finished their two reports and took them to Oliphant. He quizzed the men thoroughly, added a cover letter to their memoranda. "I have considered these suggestions in some detail and have had considerable discussion with the authors, with the result that I am convinced that the whole thing must be taken rather seriously, if only to make sure that the other side are not occupied in the production of such a bomb at the present time," and sent letter and documents off to Henry Thomas Tizard, an Oxford man, a chemist by training, the driving force behind British radar development, the civilian chairman of the Committee on the Scientific Survey of Air Defense, better known as the Tizard Committee, which was the most important British committee at the time concerned with the application of science to war. "I have often been asked," Otto Frisch wrote many years afterward, "of the moment when he understood that a bomb might be possible after all, before he and Pirls carried the news to Mark Oliphant, why I didn't abandon the project there and then, saying nothing to anybody. Why start on a project which, if it was successful, would end with the production of a weapon of unparalleled violence, a weapon of mass destruction such as the world had never seen?" The answer was very simple. We were at war. And the idea was reasonably obvious. Very probably some German scientists had had the same idea and were working on it. Whatever scientists of one warring nation could conceive, the scientists of another warring nation might also conceive and keep secret. That early in 1939 and early 1940, the nuclear arms race began. Responsible men who properly and understandably feared a dangerous enemy saw their own ideas reflected back to them malevolently distorted. Ideas that appeared defensive in friendly hands, seen the other way around, appeared aggressive. But they were the same ideas. Werner Heisenberg sent his considered conclusions to the German War Office on December 6, 1939. While Fermi and Szilard waited for the $6,000 the Briggs Uranium Committee had allocated to them for graphite studies, and Frisch prepared his pessimistic Chemical Society review. Heisenberg thought fission could lead to energy production, even with ordinary uranium, if a suitable moderator could be found. Water would not do, but heavy water, or very pure graphite would, on the other hand, suffice on present evidence. "The surest method for building a reactor," Heisenberg wrote, "will be to enrich the uranium-235 isotope. The greater the degree of enrichment, the smaller the reactor can be made." Enrichment, increasing the proportion of U-235 to U-238, was also the only method of producing explosives several orders of magnitude more powerful than the strongest explosives yet known. The phrase indicates Heisenberg understood the possibility of fast neutron fission even before Frisch and Pirls did. During the same period, Paul Hartek in Hamburg was building a Clusius separation tube. In December, he tested it by successfully separating isotopes of the heavy gas xenon. He traveled to Munich at Christmas time to discuss design improvements with Clusius, who was professor of physical chemistry at the university there. Auer, the thorium specialists, purveyors of gas mantles and radioactive toothpaste, delivered the first ton of pure uranium oxide processed from Joachimstal ores to the War Office in January 1940. German uranium research was thriving. Acquiring a suitable moderator looked more difficult. The German scientists favored heavy water, but Germany had no extraction plant of its own. Hartek calculated at the beginning of the year that a coal-fired installation would require 100,000 tons of coal for each ton of heavy water produced. an impossibility in wartime. The only source of heavy water in quantity in the world was an electrochemical plant built into a sheer 1,500-foot granite bluff beside a powerful waterfall at Vermok near Røyken, 90 miles west of Oslo in southern Norway. Norsk Hydroelektriske Vassersofitelskab produced the rare liquid as a byproduct of hydrogen electrolysis for synthetic ammonia production. IG Farben, the German chemical cartel assembled by Bears Carl Duisberg in the 1920s, owned stock in Norsk Hydro. Learning of the War Office's need, it approached the Norwegians with an offer to buy all the heavy water on hand, about 50 gallons worth some $120,000, and to order more at the rate of at least 30 gallons a month. Norsk Hydro was then producing less than 3 gallons a month, enough in the pre-war years to glut the small physics laboratory market. It wanted to know why Germany needed so vast a quantity. IG Farben chose not to say. In February, the Norwegian firm refused either to sell its existing stock or to increase production. Heavy water also impressed the French team, a fact Joliot passed on to the French Minister of Armament, Raoul Daughtry. When Daughtry heard about the German bid for Norsk Hydro's supply, he decided to win the water for France. A French bank, the Banque de Paris et des Pays-Bas, controlled a majority interest in the Norwegian company, and a former bank officer, Jacques Allier, was now a lieutenant in Daughtry's ministry. Daughtry briefed the balding, bespectacled Allier with Joliot on hand on February 20th. The minister wanted the lieutenant to lead a team of French Secret Service agents to Norway to acquire the heavy water. Allier slipped into Oslo under an assumed name and met with the general manager of Norsk Hydro at the beginning of March. The French officer was prepared to pay up to 1.5 million kroner for the water, and even to leave half for the Germans. But once the Norwegian heard what military purpose the substance might serve, he volunteered his entire stock and refused payment. The water, divided among 26 cans, left Vermork by car soon afterward on a dark midnight. From Oslo, Allier's team flew it to Edinburgh in 2 loads. German fighters forced down for inspection a decoy plane Allier had pretended to board at the time of the first landing, and then transported it by rail and channel ferry to Paris, where Joliot prepared through the winter and spring of the phony war to use it in both homogeneous and heterogeneous uranium oxide experiments. Nuclear research in the Soviet Union during this period was limited to skillful laboratory work. 2 associates of Soviet physicist Igor Kurchatov reported to the Physical Review in June 1940 that they had observed rare spontaneous fissioning in uranium. The complete lack of any American response to the publication of the discovery, writes the American physicist Herbert F. York, was one of the factors which convinced the Russians that there must be a big secret project underway in the United States. It was not yet big, but by then it had begun to be secret. Japanese studies toward an atomic bomb began first within the military. The director of the Aviation Technology Research Institute of the Imperial Japanese Army, Takeo Yasuda, a lieutenant general and an alert electrical engineer, conscientiously followed the international scientific literature that related to his field. In the course of his reading in 1938 and 1939, he noticed and tracked the discovery of nuclear fission. In April 1940, foreseeing fission's possible consequences, he ordered an aide who was scientifically trained, Lieutenant Colonel Tatsusaburo Suzuki, to prepare a full report. Suzuki went to work with a will. Niels Bohr had returned from Princeton to Copenhagen at the beginning of May 1939, preoccupied with the gathering European apocalypse. His friends had urged him to send for his family and remain in the United States. He had not been tempted. Refugees still escaping from Germany and now fleeing Central Europe as well needed him. His institute needed him. Denmark needed him. Hitler proposed on May 31st to compromise the neutrality of the Scandinavian countries with non-aggression pacts. the pragmatic Danes alone accepted, fully aware the pact was worthless and even demeaning, but unwilling to invite invasion for a paper victory. By autumn, when the John Wheelers offered to shelter one of Bohr's sons in Princeton for the duration of the conflict, Bohr reserved the offer against future need. "We are aware that a catastrophe might come any day," he wrote, in the midst of Poland's agony. Catastrophe for Denmark waited until April 1940, and came then with brutal efficiency. Bohr was lecturing in Norway. The British had announced their intention to mine Norwegian coastal waters against shipment of Norwegian iron ore to Nazi Germany. On the final evening of his lecture tour, April 8th, Bohr dined with the King of Norway, Håkon VII, and found King and government lost in gloom at the prospect of a German attack. After dinner, he boarded the night train for Copenhagen. A train ferry carried the cars across the Øresund at night to Helsingør, while the passengers slept. Danish police pounding on compartment doors woke them to the news. The Germans had invaded not only Norway, but Denmark as well. 2,000 German troops hidden in coal freighters moored near Langelinie, the Copenhagen pier of Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid, had stormed ashore in the early morning. So unexpected a sight that night shift workers bicycling home thought a motion picture was being filmed. A major German force had marched north through Schleswig-Holstein onto the Danish peninsula as well, crossing the border before dawn. German aircraft, marked with black crosses, dominated the air. German warships commanded the Kattegat and Skagerrak passages that opened Denmark and southern Norway to the North Sea. The Norwegians fought back, determined that their king, court, and parliament must escape to exile. The Danes, in their flat country where panzers might roll, did not. Rifle fire crackled in the streets of Copenhagen in the early morning, but King Christian X ordered an immediate ceasefire, which took effect at 6:25 a.m. By the time Bohr's train arrived in the capital city, what Churchill would call this ruthless coup was complete. The streets littered with green surrender leaflets, the king preparing to receive the German chief of staff. Danish resistance would be dedicated and effective, but it would take less suicidal forms than open battle with the Wehrmacht. The American embassy quickly passed word that it could guarantee the Boers safe passage to the United States. Bohr again chose duty. His immediate concern was to burn the files of the refugee committee that had helped hundreds of émigrés to escape to exile. It was characteristic of Niels Bohr, his collaborator Stefan Rosenthal writes, that one of the first things he did was to contact the chancellor of the university and other Danish authorities in order to protect those of the staff at the institute whom the Germans might be expected to persecute. Those were Poles, first of all. But Bohr also sought out government leaders to argue for concerted Danish resistance to any German attempt to install anti-Semitic laws in Denmark. He even found time on the day of the occupation to worry about the large gold Nobel Prize medals that Vox von Lau and James Franck had given him for safekeeping. Exporting gold from Germany was a serious criminal offense, and their names were engraved on the medals. George de Hevesy devised an effective solution. Literally, he dissolved the metals separately in acid. As solutions of black liquid in unmarked jars, they sat out the war innocently on a laboratory shelf. Afterward, the Nobel Foundation recast them and returned them to their owners. Norsk Hydro was a prime German objective, and there was heavy fighting around Rjukan, which held out until May 3rd, the last town in southern Norway to surrender. Then a management under duress reported to Paul Hartek that its heavy water facility, the Vemork High Concentration Plant, could be expanded to increase production of the ideal neutron moderator to as much as 1.5 tons per year. "What I should like," Henry Tizard wrote Mark Oliphant after he had studied the Friesch Peierls memoranda, would be to have quite a small committee to sit soon to advise what ought to be done, who should do it, and where it should be done, and I suggest that you, Thompson, and, say, Blackett, would form a sufficient nucleus for such a committee. Thompson was G.P. Thompson, J.J.'s son, the Imperial College physicist who had ordered up a ton of uranium oxide the previous year to study and felt ashamed at the absurdity. He had concluded after neutron bombardment experiments that a chain reaction in natural uranium was unlikely, and a war project therefore impractical. Tizard, who had been skeptical to begin with, and had taken Thompson's conclusions as support for his skepticism, appointed Thompson chairman of the small committee. James Chadwick, now at Liverpool, his assistant P.B. Moon, and Rutherford protege Don Douglas Cockcroft were added to the list. Blackett was busy with other war work, although he would join the committee later. The group met informally for the first time on April 10th in the Royal Society's quarters at Burlington House. It probably meant as much to hear a visitor, the ubiquitous Jacques Allier of the Banque de Paris and the French Ministry of Armament, as to discuss the Friche Pirrell's work. Allier warned the British physicists about the German interest in heavy water production and bid for collaboration on nuclear research between Britain and France. Only then, Thompson notes in the minutes he kept, did they consider the possibility of separating isotopes, and it was agreed that the prospects were sufficiently good to justify small-scale experiments on uranium hexafluoride, a gaseous uranium compound. They proposed, rather ungenerously, to remind Friche to avoid any possible leakage of news in view of the interest shown by the Germans. They were willing to inform him that his memorandum was being considered, but not to supply details. Pirrell's name seems not yet to have made an impression on Thompson, and Tizard apparently retained the second Friche Pirrell's memorandum in his files. "We entered the project with more skepticism than belief," the committee would report later, "though we felt it was a matter which had to be investigated." Thompson's minutes make that skepticism evident. Tizard, for his part, wrote Lindemann's brother Charles, a science advisor to the British Embassy in Paris, that he considered the French unnecessarily excited about the perils of German nuclear research. "I still think that the probability of anything of real military significance is very low," he estimated in a note written the same week to the British War Cabinet staff. It might have been as unpromising a start as the first meeting of the Briggs Uranium Committee had been, but the men on the Thompson Committee were active, competent physicists, not military ordnance specialists. And whatever their initial skepticism, they understood where the numbers Friche and Pirrell had used came from and what they might mean. At a second meeting on April 24th, Thompson recorded laconically that Dr. Friche produced some notes to show that the uranium bomb was feasible. Many years later, Oliphant recalled a more expansive response. "The committee generally was electrified by the possibility." Chadwick's good opinion helped. He had just begun exploring fast neutron fission himself with his new Liverpool cyclotron, the first in England, when he saw the Friche-Pirrell's memorandum. At the April 24th meeting, he awarded the émigré's work chagrined confirmation. "He was embarrassed," says Oliphant, confessing that he had reached similar conclusions, but did not feel justified in reporting them until more was known about the neutron cross-sections from experiments. Pirrell and Friche had used calculated values. However, this confirmatory evidence led the committee to pay great attention to the development of techniques for separation. Chadwick agreed to undertake the necessary studies. For several more weeks, until their protests through Oliphant registered with Thompson, Friche and Pirrell would be walled off from their own secrets. But work toward a bomb of chain-reacting uranium was now fairly begun, and this time it had found the right, fast track. Szilard chafed. The months after the first Uranium Committee meeting became the most curious period of my life. No one called. We heard nothing from Washington at all. I had assumed that once we had demonstrated that in the fission of uranium neutrons are emitted, there would be no difficulty in getting people interested. But I was wrong. The Uranium Committee's November 1 report had in fact been languishing in Roosevelt's files. Watson finally decided on his own in early February in 1940 to bring it up again. He asked Lyman Briggs if he had anything to add. Briggs reported the transfer, finally, of the $6,000 for Fermi's work on neutron absorption in graphite. That was a crucial undertaking, Briggs said. He imagined it would determine whether or not the undertaking has a practical application. He proposed to wait for results. Something other than Briggs's penurious methodology triggered a new burst of activity from Szilard. He had spent the winter preparing a thorough theoretical study, divergent chain reactions in systems composed of uranium and carbon. Divergent, in this case, meaning chain reactions that continue to multiply once begun. The document's first footnote, numbered 0, cited H.G. Wells, The World Set Free, 1913. Early in the new year, Joliot's group reported a uranium water experiment that seemed to come so close to being chain reacting, says Szilard, that if we improved the system somewhat by replacing water with graphite, in my opinion, we should have gotten over the hump. He arranged lunch with Fermi to discuss the French paper. I asked him, "Did you read Joliot's paper?" He said he did. I asked him, "What did you think of it?" And Fermi said, "Not much." Szilard was furious, at which point I saw no reason to continue the conversation and went home. He traveled again to Princeton to see Einstein. They worked up another letter and sent it under Einstein's signature to Sachs. It emphasized the secret German uranium research at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, about which they had learned from the physical chemist Peter Debye, the 1936 Nobel laureate in chemistry and director of the Physics Institute at Dahlem, who had been expelled recently to the United States, ostensibly on leave of absence, when he refused to give up Dutch citizenship and join the Nazi Reich. Sachs sent the Einstein letter on to Pa Watson for FDR. But Watson thought it sensible to check first with the Uranium Committee. Adamson responded, echoing Briggs. Everything depended on the graphite measurements at Columbia. Watson proposed to wait for the official report. Sachs may have rebutted. Roosevelt wrote the Gadfly Economist on April 5th, emphasizing that the Briggs Committee was the most practical method of continuing this research, but also calling for another committee meeting that Sachs might attend. Briggs dutifully scheduled it for Saturday afternoon, April 27th. In the meantime, another development intervened. Alfred Nyer at the University of Minnesota had gone to work, after Fermi wrote, urging him again to do so, to prepare to separate measurable samples of U-235 and U-238. John Dunning sent him uranium hexafluoride, a highly corrosive compound that is a white solid at room temperature, but volatilizes to a gas when heated to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. "I worked with this for a couple of months in late 1939, Nyer remembers. Unfortunately, the gas was too volatile. It dispersed through Nyer's 3-foot glass spectrometer tube, despite the best efforts of his vacuum pump to clear it, and contaminated the collector plates. Finally, I said, this won't do." A new instrument was built in about 10 days in February 1940. Our glassblower bent the horseshoe-shaped mass spectrometer tube for me. I made the metal parts myself. As a source of uranium, I used the less volatile uranium tetrachloride and tetrabromide left over from his earlier Harvard experiments. The first separation of U-235 and U-238 was actually accomplished on February 28th and 29th, 1940. It was a leap year, and on Friday afternoon, February 29th, I pasted the little samples collected on nickel foil on the margin of a handwritten letter and delivered them to the Minneapolis post office at about 6 o'clock. The letter was sent by airmail, special delivery, and arrived at Columbia University on Saturday. I was aroused early Sunday morning by a long-distance telephone call from John Dunning, who had worked through the night bombarding the samples with neutrons from the Columbia cyclotron. The Columbia test of the samples clearly showed that U-235 was responsible for the slow neutron fission of uranium. The demonstration vindicated Bohr's hypothesis, but it also led Briggs to even greater suspicion of the value of natural uranium. "It was very doubtful," he reported to Watson on April 9th, "whether a chain reaction can be established without separating 235 from the rest of the uranium." Nyer, Dunning, and their collaborators, Eugene T. Booth and Aristide von Gross, had written much the same thing in the Physical Review on March 15th. These experiments emphasize the importance of uranium isotope separation on a larger scale for the investigation of chain reaction possibilities in uranium. But isotope separation was Dunning's approach to the problem in the first place, and his enthusiasm as well. The slow neutron finding hardly ruled out the Fermi-Szilard system. More misleading may have been the measurements Nyer and the Columbia team published on April 15th using larger, but still microscopic, samples. Furthermore, the number of fissions per microgram of U-238 observed under these neutron intensity conditions is sufficient to account for practically all the fast neutron fission observed in unseparated U. The statement was correct within the limits of measurement for such small samples, but its wording seems to deprecate U-235 fast neutron fission. In fact, Nyer had not collected enough U-235 to allow Columbia to measure that possibility. All anyone knew by then was that the U-235 cross-section for fast neutron fission was less than the isotope's cross-section for slow neutron fission. But that cross-section, as the first Nyer-Columbia paper reported, was a whopping 400 to 500 times 10 to the negative 24 centimeters squared. Predictably, then, when the Uranium Committee met on April 27th, with Sachs, Pegram, Fermi, Szilard, and Wigner in attendance, it listened to the renewed debate, squared its shoulders at Sachs' exhortation to plunge ahead, and never wavered in its adamant conviction that a large-scale uranium graphite experiment should await the outcome of Fermi's graphite measurements. Now that the $6,000 had been paid, Columbia was able to buy the graphite Szilard had tracked down for Fermi's use. Cartons of carefully wrapped graphite bricks began to arrive at the Pupin Laboratory, Herbert Anderson remembers, 4 tons in all. Fermi returned to the chain reaction problem with enthusiasm. This was the kind of physics he liked best. Together we stacked the graphite bricks in a neat pile. We cut narrow slots in some of the bricks for the rhodium foil detectors we wanted to insert, and soon we were ready to make measurements. So the physicists on the 7th floor of Pupin Laboratory started looking like coal miners, adds Fermi. And the wives, to whom these physicists came back tired at night, were wondering what was happening. The arrangement was designed to determine how far neutrons from a radon-beryllium source set in paraffin on the floor under the graphite column would diffuse up the column through the graphite, after first slowing down in scattering collisions. The farther the neutrons traveled, the smaller was carbon's absorption cross-section, and therefore the better moderator it would be. The Pupin's 7th floor became a racetrack like the 2nd floor of the Institute in Rome. Anderson describes the scene. A precise schedule was followed for each measurement. With the rhodium in place in the graphite, the source was inserted in its position inside the pile and removed after a 1-minute exposure. To get the rhodium foil under the Geiger counter in the allotted 20 seconds, because its induced half-life is only 44 seconds, took coordination and some fast legwork. The division of labor was typical. I removed the source on signal. Fermi, stopwatch in hand, grabbed the rhodium and raced down the hall at top speed. He had just enough time to place the foil carefully into position, close the lead shield, and, at the prescribed moment, start the count. Then, with obvious satisfaction at seeing everything go right, he would watch the flashing lights on the scaler, tapping his fingers on the bench in time with the clicking of the register. Such a display of the phenomenon of radioactivity never failed to delight him. The absorption cross-section, as Fermi and Anderson subsequently calculated it, proved usefully small, 3 times 10 to the negative 27th centimeter squared, and could be made smaller still, they thought, with purer graphite. The measurement strongly supported Fermi's and Szilard's plan to attempt to induce a slow neutron chain reaction in natural uranium. But while such a plan might demonstrate a potential future source of power, the American scientists and administrators who were advising Briggs could not yet identify any military use. In April, the British Thompson Committee asked A.V. Hill, a scientific advisor to the British Embassy in Washington, to find out what the Americans were doing about fission. According to the official history of the British Atomic Energy Program, Hill talked to unidentified scientists of the Carnegie Institution, whose opinions he reported pungently. "It is not inconceivable that practical engineering applications and war use may emerge in the end, but I am assured by American colleagues that there is no sign of them at present, and that it would be a sheer waste of time for people busy with urgent matters in England to turn to uranium as a war investigation. If anything likely to be of war value emerges, they will certainly give us a hint of it in good time. A large number of American physicists are working on or interested in the subject. They have excellent facilities and equipment. They are extremely well disposed towards us, and they feel that it is much better that they should be pressing on with this than our people should be wasting their time on what is scientifically very interesting, but for present practical needs, probably a wild goose chase." The opinion from the Carnegie may have been hard-headed, but it was based on more than prejudice. Roberts, Hofstad, and fellow DTM physicist Norman P. Heidenberg had improved their measurements of cross-sections for fast neutron fission, scattering, and capture in natural uranium. Using their numbers, Edward Teller, in one of the many calculations he made during this period, arrived at a critical mass in excess of 30 tons, the same order of magnitude as Perrin and Pirls had calculated before him. With only slightly more pessimistic assumptions, Roberts concluded that the cross-section for capture in natural uranium is sufficiently large that it now seems impossible for a fast neutron chain reaction to occur, even in an infinitely large block of pure uranium. By the spring of 1940, experiments at Columbia and the DTM thus had ruled out both slow and significant fast neutron fission in U-238, and ruled out slow neutron fission in U-235. The asymmetry might have been a clue. No one picked it up. Since at least the time of Einstein's first letter to FDR, Edward Teller had debated with himself the morality of weapons work. His life had twice been cruelly uprooted by totalitarianism. He understood Germany's frightening technological advantages at the outset of the war. "I came to the United States in 1935, he notes. The handwriting was on the wall. At that time, I believed that Hitler would conquer the world unless a miracle happened. But pure science still pacified him. To deflect my attention from physics, my full-time job, which I liked, to work on weapons, was not an easy matter. And for quite a time, I did not make up my mind." The accidental juxtaposition of two events led him to decision. In the spring of 1940, it was announced that President Roosevelt would speak to a Pan-American Scientific Congress in Washington, and as one of the professors of George Washington University, I was invited. I did not intend to go. The other event of that crucial day, May 10, 1940, reversed his intention. The phony war abruptly ended. With 77 divisions and 3,500 aircraft, Germany, without declaration or warning, invaded Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg to make way for the invasion of France. Teller thought Roosevelt might speak to that outrage. In his voluntary pre-war isolation, he had never bothered, Teller says, to visit the capital or listen to one of FDR's radio talks or otherwise involve himself in the political life of his adopted country. But he wanted now to see the President of the United States in person. Alone among the scientists at the Congress, Teller knew about the Einstein letter. It was a direct link. He was an emotional man, and the encounter with Roosevelt was eerily personal. We had never met, but I had an irrational feeling he was talking to me. The President mentioned the German invasion, its challenge to the continuance of the type of civilization the people of the Americas valued, the distances of the modern world shortened by modern technology to timetables that removed the mystic immunity Americans once felt from European war. Then he started to talk about the role of the scientist, Teller recalls, who had been accused of inventing deadly weapons. He concluded, if the scientists in the free countries will not make weapons to defend the freedom of their countries, then freedom will be lost. Teller believed Roosevelt was not proposing what scientists may do, but something that was our duty and that we must do, to work out the military problems, because without the work of the scientists, the war and the world would be lost. Teller's memory of Roosevelt's speech differs from its text. The president said that most people abhor conquest and war and bloodshed. He said that the search for truth was a great adventure, but that in other parts of the world, teachers and scholars are not permitted that search, an observation of which Teller had personal knowledge. And then, cannily, Roosevelt offered absolution in advance for war work. "You who are scientists may have been told that you are in part responsible for the debacle of today, but I assure you, it is not the scientists of the world who are responsible. What has come about has been caused solely by those who would use, and are using, the progress that you have made along lines of peace in an entirely different cause." "My mind was made up," Teller reports, "and it has not changed since." Vannevar Bush made a similar choice that spring. The sharp-eyed Yankee engineer, who looked like a beardless Uncle Sam, had left his MIT vice presidency for the Carnegie Institution in the first place to position himself closer to the sources of government authority as war approached. Carl Compton had offered to move up to chairman of the MIT Corporation and give him the presidency to keep him, but Bush had larger plans. As a young man, with a doctorate in engineering behind him jointly from MIT and Harvard earned in one intense year, Bush in 1917 had gone patriotically to work for a research corporation developing a magnetic submarine detector. The device was effective, and 100 sets got built. But because of bureaucratic confusion, they were never put to use against German submarines. "That experience," Bush writes in a memoir, "forced into my mind pretty solidly the complete lack of proper liaison between the military and the civilian in the development of weapons in time of war, and what that lack meant." In Washington after the invasion of Poland, the Carnegie president gathered with a group of fellow science administrators, Frank Jewett, president of Bell Telephone Laboratories and the National Academy of Sciences, James Bryant Conant, the young president of Harvard, a distinguished chemist, Richard Tolman of Caltech, the theoretician who had wooed Einstein, Carl Compton, to worry about the approaching conflict. It was during the period of the phony war. We were agreed that the war was bound to break out into an intense struggle, that America was sure to get into it one way or another sooner or later, that it would be a highly technical struggle, that we were by no means prepared in this regard, and finally, and most importantly, that the military system as it existed would never fully produce the new instrumentalities which we would certainly need. They devised a national organization to do the job. Bush had learned his way around Washington and took the lead. The organization Bush wanted needed independent authority. He thought it should report directly to the president, rather than through military channels, and should have its own source of funds. He drafted a proposal. Then he arranged an introduction to Harry Hopkins. A small-town Iowa boy, idealistic and energetic, Harry Lloyd Hopkins had fallen into New York social work after 4 years at Grinnell and won appointment at the beginning of the Depression administering emergency state relief. When the governor of New York was elected president, Hopkins moved with Roosevelt to Washington to help out with the New Deal. He ran the vast Works Progress Administration, then took over as Secretary of Commerce. His performance moved him closer and closer to the president, who picked up talent wherever he could find it. As war approached, Roosevelt invited Hopkins to dinner at the White House one evening and moved the man in for the duration as his closest advisor and aide. Hopkins was tall, a chain smoker, and emaciated to the point of cachexia, his ghastly health the result of cancer surgery that took most of his stomach and left him unable to absorb much protein, and therefore slowly starving to death. He kept an office in the White House basement, but usually worked out of a cluttered bedroom suite, the Lincoln bedroom, down the hall from FDR's. When Bush met Hopkins, though the presidential aide was a liberal Democrat, and the Carnegie president an admirer of Herbert Hoover and a self-styled Tory, something meshed, writes Bush, and we found we spoke the same language. Hopkins had a scheme for an inventor's council. Bush countered with his more comprehensive National Defense Research Council. Each of us was trying to sell something to the other. Bush won. Hopkins liked his plan. In early June, Bush made the rounds of Washington touching bases. The Army, the Navy, Congress, the National Academy of Sciences. On June 12th, Harry and I then went in to see the president. It was the first time I had met Franklin D. Roosevelt. I had the plan for the NDRC in four short paragraphs in the middle of a sheet of paper. The whole audience lasted less than 10 minutes. Harry had no doubt been there before me. I came out with my OKFDR, and all the wheels began to turn. The National Defense Research Council immediately absorbed the Uranium Committee. That had been part of its purpose. Briggs was a cautious and frugal man, but his committee had also lacked the authority of a source of funds independent of the military. The white-haired director of the National Bureau of Standards would continue to be responsible for fission work. He would report now to James Bryant Conant, Harvard's wiry president, boyish in appearance but in practice cool and reserved, whom Bush had enlisted as soon as FDR authorized the new council. The NDRC gave research in nuclear fission an articulate lobby within the executive branch. But though Bush and Conant felt challenged by German science, a threat of a possible atomic bomb, writes Bush, was in all our minds, both men, concerned about scarce scientific resources, were initially more interested in proving the impossibility of such a weapon than in rushing to build one. The Germans could not do what could not be done. When Briggs wrapped up his pre-NDRC committee work in a report to Bush on July 1st, he asked for $140,000, $40,000 of it for research on cross-sections and other fundamental physical constants, $100,000 for the Fermi-Szilard large-scale uranium graphite experiment. The military had decided to grant $100,000 on its own through the Naval Research Laboratory to isotope separation studies. Bush allotted Briggs only the $40,000. Once again, Fermi and Szilard were left to bide their time. Winston Churchill had accepted George VI's invitation to form a government upon Neville Chamberlain's resignation the day Germany invaded the lowlands. He shouldered the prime ministership calmly, but felt the somber weight of office. C.P. Snow recalls a more paradoxical mood. I remember, I shall not forget it while I live, the beautiful, cloudless, desperate summer of 1940. Oddly enough, most of us were very happy in those days. There was a kind of collective euphoria over the whole country. I don't know what we were thinking about. We were very busy. We had a purpose. We were living in constant excitement, usually, if we examined the true position, of an unpromising kind. In one's realistic moments, it was difficult to see what chance we had. But I doubt if most of us had many realistic moments, or thought much at all. We were all working like mad. We were sustained by a surge of national emotion, of which Churchill was both symbol and essence, evocator and voice. Not only native-born Englishmen felt that surge, so did the émigré scientists whom Britain had sheltered. Franz Simon, an outstanding chemist whom Frederick Lindemann had extracted from Germany in 1933 for the Clarendon, wrote his old friend Max Born on the eve of the Battle of France that he longed to use my whole force in the struggle for this country. Though he may not yet have realized it, Simon's opportunity had already arrived. Early in the year, when Frisch and Peierls were first beginning to discuss the ideas that would lead to their important memoranda, Peierls had consulted Simon about methods of isotope separation. Frisch had chosen to work with gaseous thermal diffusion, his Clusius tube, because it seemed to him the simplest method. But Simon had begun then to think about other systems. Half a dozen approaches had been tried in the past. You couldn't spit on the floor without separating isotopes, Simon joked. The problem was to collect them. He wanted to find a method adaptable to mass production, because with a 1 to 139 isotope ratio, uranium separation would have to proceed on a vast scale, as Frisch's calculation of 100,000 Clusius tubes demonstrated. Frisch dramatized the difficulty with a simile. It was like getting a doctor who had, after great labor, made a minute quantity of a new drug, and then saying to him, "Now we want enough to pave the streets." The surge of national emotion sustained Mark Oliphant as well, and in that mood he found even less patience than usual for obstructive rules. When P.B. Moon questioned the assumption that gaseous thermal diffusion was the method of choice for isotope separation, he won no encouragement from the Thompson Committee. But back in Birmingham, Oliphant simply told him to go ahead and talk it over with Peierls. "Within a week or two," writes Moon, "Peierls identified ordinary diffusion as a logically superior process and wrote directly to Thompson on the matter. Peierls proposed that the Thompson Committee consult with Simon, the best man around. The committee hesitated, even though Simon was a naturalized citizen. Oliphant then authorized Peierls out of hand to visit Simon at Oxford. Simon, in the meantime, had been working to convert a skeptical Lindemann. At Simon's suggestion, Peierls had written to Lindemann on June 2nd. Together at Oxford later in June, they approached Lindemann in person. "I do not know him sufficiently well to translate his grunts correctly," Peierls reported of the meeting. But he felt sure he had convinced him that the whole thing ought to be taken seriously. Like Peierls, Simon had settled on ordinary gaseous diffusion, as opposed to gaseous thermal diffusion, as the best method of isotope separation after winnowing through the alternatives. Gases diffuse through porous materials at rates that are determined by their molecular weight, lighter gases diffusing faster than heavier gases. Francis Aston had applied this principle in 1913 when he separated two isotopes of neon by diffusing a mixed sample several thousand times over and over through pipe clay. That is, unglazed bisque of the sort used to make clay pipes. Thick materials, like pipe clay, work too slowly to be effective at factory scale. Simon sought a more efficient mechanism and concluded that a metal foil punctured with millions of microscopic holes would work faster. Divide a cylinder down its length with such a foil barrier. Pump a gas of mixed isotopes into one side of the divided cylinder, and gas would diffuse through the barrier as it flowed from one end of the cylinder to the other. Compared to the gas left behind, the gas that diffused through the barrier would be selectively enriched in lighter isotopes. In the case of uranium hexafluoride, the enrichment factor would be slight, 1.0043 under ideal conditions. But with enough repetitions of the process, any degree of enrichment was possible, up to nearly 100%. The immediate problem Simon saw was barrier material. The smaller the holes, the higher the pressure a separation system could sustain, and the higher the pressure, the smaller the equipment could be. Whatever the material, it would have to resist corrosion by uranium hexafluoride. Hex, they were beginning to call it, not necessarily in tribute to its evil contrarieties, or the gas would clog its microscopic pores. One morning that June, inspired, Simon took a hammer to a wire strainer he found in his kitchen. He carried the results to the Clarendon and called together two of his assistants, a Hungarian, Nicholas Kurti, and a big Rhodes scholar from Idaho, H.S. Arms. "Arms, Kurti," Simon announced, holding up the strainer. "I think we can now separate the isotopes." He had hammered the wires flat in demonstration, reducing the spaces between to pinholes. "The first thing we used," Kurti recalls, "was Dutch cloth, as I think it is called, a very fine copper gauze, which has many hundreds of holes to the inch." The assistants hammered the holes even finer by hand. They tested the copper barrier not with hex, but with a mixture of water vapor and carbon dioxide. In other words, something much like ordinary soda water. The first in an urgent series of experiments carried out through the summer and fall to study materials, pore size, pressures, and other basic parameters preliminary to any equipment design. In late June, G.P. Thompson gave his committee a new name to disguise its activities, MAUD. The initials appear to form an acronym, but do not. They arrived as a mysterious word in a cable from Lise Meitner to an English friend. Met Niels and Margaret recently, both well but unhappy about events. Please inform Cockcroft and Maud Ray Kent. Meitner's friend passed the message to Cockcroft, who decided, he wrote Chadwick, that Maud Ray Kent was an anagram for radium taken. This agrees with other information that the Germans are getting hold of all the radium they can. Thompson borrowed the first word of Cockcroft's mysterious anagram for a suitably misleading name. The committee members did not learn until 1943 that Maud Ray was the governess who had taught Bohr's sons English. She lived in Kent. The war crossed the Channel first in the air. As a result of the German bombing of Warsaw in the autumn of 1939, an act Germany represented as tactical because the Polish city was heavily fortified, the British Air Ministry had repudiated its pledge to refrain from strategic bombing. But neither belligerent was eager to exchange bombing raids, and although nightly blackouts added inconvenience and apprehension to the wartime burden of the people of both nations, the implicit truce held until mid-May 1940. Then, within a week, two events triggered British action. German raiders, targeted for French airfields at Dijon, lost their way and bombed the southern German city of Freiburg instead, killing 57 people. The German Ministry of Propaganda brazenly denounced the bombing as British or French and threatened fivefold retaliation. Blacker and more violent non sequitur destroyed the city center of Rotterdam. Dutch forces were holding out stubbornly as late as May 14th in the northern section of that old Netherlands port. The German commanding general ordered a short but devastating air raid that he hoped might decide the battle. Negotiations with the Dutch advanced. The air raid was canceled. But the abort message arrived too late to stop half the 100 Heinkel 111s ordered into action from dropping 94 tons of bombs. The bombs started massive fires in stores of fats and margarine. The first official Dutch statement, issued from the embassy in Washington, placed casualties in the devastated city at 30,000. And the Western democracies responded with outrage. Actual deaths totaled about 1,000. Some 78,000 people went homeless. The British retaliated on May 15th by dispatching 99 bombers to attack railway centers and supply depots in the Ruhr. Busy with the Battle of France, Hitler did not immediately strike back, but he issued a directive that prepared the way. He ordered the Luftwaffe to undertake a full-scale offensive against the British homeland as soon as sufficient forces are available. The initial German air attack, the Battle of Britain, began in mid-August. A month of ferocious daylight contests between the Luftwaffe and British Fighter Command for air supremacy in advance of Operation Sea Lion, Germany's planned cross-channel invasion. It was not yet an attack on cities. British airfields and aircraft factories were primary targets. Hitler had reserved for himself the decision to bomb London, just as the Kaiser had done before him. Cities would soon go on the targeting list, however. The Luftwaffe was scheduled to raid Liverpool at night on August 28th. Accident again intervened. German bombers, aiming for oil storage tanks along the Thames, overflew their targets on August 24th and bombed central London instead. Churchill immediately retaliated, hurling four bombing raids in 1 week at Berlin. They accomplished little physical damage, but incited Hitler to hysterical revenge. "And if the British Air Force drops 2 or 3 or 4,000 kilograms of bombs, then we will drop in a single night 150,000, 180,000, 230,000, 300,000, 400,000, 1,000,000 kilograms. If they announce that they will attack our cities on a large scale, then we shall wipe their cities out." The Luftwaffe was losing the Battle of Britain, in any case, taking unacceptable losses, some 1,700 German aircraft compared to about 900 British. Night bombing would alleviate the losses, curtaining the bombers in dark asylum. But night bombing was notably less accurate than daylight bombing in those days before effective radar and required correspondingly larger targets. Cities and their civilian populations thus fell victim partly by default because the technology necessary for more accurate targeting was not yet at hand. In any case, terror was a weapon that Hitler especially prized, the destruction of what he called the enemy's will to resist. And early in September, he told his Sea Lion planners that a systematic and long-drawn-out bombardment of London might produce an attitude in the enemy which will make Sea Lion unnecessary. He ordered the bombardment. Since it rained from the skies for months, it was hardly blitzkrieg, lightning war. But the citizens exposed beneath it were not in the mood for fine distinctions, and they soon named it the Blitz. Gresham's law operated with air raid shelters as it operates with good and bad money. The basements of better department stores like Dickens and Jones, where clerks carried around refreshments, chocolates and ice cream, filled up first. Because the bombing followed regularly, night after night, Londoners had time to get used to it. But adjustment could go either way. The confident beginner slowly unraveling, the frightened beginner moving beyond fear. More Londoners by far lived out the dangerous raids in their homes than in shelters. 27% fled to corrugated iron Anderson shelters in back gardens, 9% to street shelters, only 4% into the tube. By mid-November, 13,700 tons of high explosives had fallen, and 12,600 tons of incendiary canisters, an average of 201 tons per night. For the entire Blitz, September to May, the total tonnage reached 18,800, 18.8 kilotons by modern measure, spread across 9 months. London civilian deaths in 1940 and 1941 totaled 20,083. Civilian deaths elsewhere in Britain, 23,602. For a total death by Blitz in the second and third year of the war, about which the United States was still officially neutral, of 43,685. After that, the bombing went the other way. Only 27 Londoners lost their lives to bombs in 1942. At Oxford in December 1940, Franz Simon, now officially working for the Maud Committee, produced a report nearly as crucial to the future of uranium bomb development as the original Friedrich-Perls memoranda had been. It was titled, Estimate of the Size of an Actual Separation Plant. Its aim, Simon wrote, was to provide data for the size and costs of a plant which separates 1 kilogram per day of U-235 from the natural product. He estimated such a plant could cost about £5 million and outlined its necessities in careful detail. Simon had never trusted the mails. He trusted them even less at the height of the Blitz. He duplicated some 40 copies of his report, accumulated enough rationed gasoline for a round trip, and shortly before Christmas drove from Oxford into bomb-threatened London to deliver the fruit of half a year's hard work, his whole force in the struggle for his country, to G.P. Thompson. The Germans may have been collecting radium, as Cockcroft thought Maud Ray Kent signaled. They were certainly laying in industrial stocks of uranium. In June 1940, about the time Simon was hammering out his kitchen strainer, Auer ordered 60 tons of refined uranium oxide from the Union Minière in occupied Belgium. Paul Hartek in Hamburg tried that month to measure neutron multiplication in an ingenious arrangement of uranium oxide and dry ice, frozen carbon dioxide, a source of carbon free from any impurity other than oxygen, but was unable to convince Heisenberg to lend him enough uranium to guarantee unambiguous results. Heisenberg had larger plans. He had allied himself with von Weizsacker at the KWI. In July, they began designing a wooden laboratory building to be constructed on the grounds of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Biology and Virus Research, next to the Physics Institute. To discourage the curious, they named the building the Virus House. They intended to build a subcritical uranium burner there. Germany had access to the world's only heavy water factory and to thousands of tons of uranium ore in Belgium and the Belgian Congo. It had chemical plants second to none and competent physicists, chemists, and engineers. It lacked only a cyclotron for measuring nuclear constants. The fall of France, Paris was occupied June 14th, an armistice signed June 22nd, filled that need. Kurt Deibner, the War Office's resident nuclear physics expert, rushed to Paris. Perrine, von Halben, and Kowarski, he found, had escaped to England and taken Allier's 26 cans of heavy water with them. But Joliot had chosen to remain in France. The French laureate would become president of the Directing Committee of the National Front, the largest resistance organization of the war. German officers interrogated Joliot at length when he returned to his laboratory after the occupation began. Their interpreter, sent along from Heidelberg, turned out to be Wolfgang Gentner, the former Radium Institute student who had confirmed that Joliot's Geiger counter was working properly when Joliot discovered artificial radioactivity in 1933. Gentner arranged a secret meeting one evening at a student cafe and warned Joliot that the cyclotron he was building might be seized and shipped to Germany. Rather than allow that outrage, Joliot negotiated a compromise. The cyclotron would stay, but German physicists could use it for purely scientific experiments. Joliot would be allowed in turn to continue as laboratory director. The Virus House was finished in October. Besides a laboratory, the structure contained a special brick-lined pit, 6 feet deep, a variant of Fermi's water tank for neutron multiplication studies. By December, Heisenberg and von Weizsacker had prepared the first of several such experiments. With water in the pit to serve as both reflector and radiation shield, they lowered down a large aluminum canister packed with alternating layers of uranium oxide and paraffin. A radium-beryllium source in the center of the canister supplied neutrons, but the German physicists were able to measure no neutron multiplication at all. The experiment confirmed what Fermi and Szilard had already demonstrated, that ordinary hydrogen, whether in the form of water or paraffin, would not work with natural uranium to sustain a chain reaction. That understanding left the German project with two possible moderator materials, graphite and heavy water. In January, a misleading measurement reduced that number to one. At Heidelberg, Walter Botha, an exceptional experimentalist who would eventually share a Nobel Prize with Max Born, measured the absorption cross-section of carbon using a 3.6-foot sphere of high-quality graphite submerged in a tank of water. He found a cross-section of 6.4 times 10 to the negative 27th centimeters squared, more than twice Fermi's value, and concluded that graphite, like ordinary water, would absorb too many neutrons to sustain a chain reaction in natural uranium. Von Halben and Kowarski, now at Cambridge and in contact with the Maud Committee, similarly overestimated the carbon cross-section. The graphite in both experiments was probably contaminated with neutron-absorbing impurities such as boron. But their work was eventually checked against Fermi's. Botha could make no such check. The previous fall, Szilard had assaulted Fermi with another secrecy appeal. When Fermi finished his carbon absorption measurement, the question of secrecy again came up. I went to his office and said that now we had this value, perhaps the value ought not to be made public. And this time Fermi really lost his temper. He really thought this was absurd. There was nothing much more I could say. But next time, when I dropped in his office, he told me that Pegram had come to see him, and Pegram thought that this value should not